Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Carla M. from Van Nuys.
Hi, everybody. My name's Carla Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. Excuse me. I want to thank Paul for inviting me out here to share with you guys tonight. It is always a privilege to be able to do this, to share my story and or my perspective on my story anyway, and that's always changing. The story doesn't change much, but and you know, keep the moments alive. Keep the moments alive that got me here and the moments that keep me here, and hopefully the newcomer will hear something that brings you back in tomorrow, and hopefully if you've been around a while and you're just coasting along or maybe suffering a little bit like I have from time to time, maybe I'll get to say something, or maybe we'll just sit in the room tonight and stay sober till midnight one more time. I don't know, but I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank Gloria for coming down with me. And it's a week, I'm going to be married a week from tomorrow, and before that, I'll get the important statistic out of the way. My sobriety date is September 25th, 1987. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gotten here after when my marriage was completely falling apart. The cops had been to our apartment that afternoon. One more time, we were the neighborhood entertainment, and they took the gun, and the husband left for the last time, and my 10-year-old daughter, who I had already lost once, was standing in the corner and looking very, very frightened, and I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop drinking, and to think that I could have the life that I have today and be marrying the man that I'm marrying today. I mean, the man I'm marrying today, I almost missed him. You know, I just almost walk right by him. He's perpetually joyful. He has no recent prison experience, and he's nonviolent, and I just almost missed him. But I'm a little emotionally, hi, and I watched the royal wedding, the warm-up for our wedding, today, and then we'll have the real deal, of course, next week. So if I'm a little scattered, I have to apologize. I'm probably more self-centered than I'd like to be, but I'm very excited at the same time, because it never would have been on my list that this could have happened. When I got here, I was very, very serious, and I thought, what the hell is so funny around here? If I could pay rent for more than a month in a row, that would be good. You know, can we learn how to do that? And so what I've been given in sobriety has been 1,000 times more than I would have ever known to ask for. So having said that, when I got here, I would have told you that I was an alcoholic because of the crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family I had. If you had my family, you'd drink too. And it was all about that. I found out that since I've been here, that'll give you an inventory, but it didn't make me alcoholic. There are people who live far worse childhoods than I ever could imagine, and when they take a drink, what happens to me doesn't happen to them. They can control the amount they're going to take. Alcohol doesn't do for them what it did for me. And there are people, conversely, who have been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, who lived charmed childhoods, who nothing ever happened to them. They lived, they were loved, they were needed, they were wanted, they had everything they could possibly imagine, and yet when they pick up a drink of alcohol, they can't control the amount they're going to take, and when they stop for any amount of time, they can't stay stopped, because that huge obsession that alcohol is once again going to do it for them just gets so big that sooner or later we all got to come to this a glass of alcohol and pick it up and drink it. And that's what we have in common. We have that common problem and the common solution that it took me a long time to learn that. And I don't want you to think my childhood was all bad, though. I had a great time in elementary school. Fourth, fifth, and sixth grade were just terrific. I had a good time. I was one of those kids. I was a new kid on the block all the time, many times. And the way I found my way in was by being first and the most and the best. And I found my way into politics, school politics, and I ran for office, and I was great in softball, and I ran around the track, and I had to be first. And academics, my hand was up, and I knew the answer. And just, you know, I just had to be in there. And God, by the time sixth grade was over, I was tired, and I needed a drink bad. And running the world when you're 10 is a big, big job, and I was there. And I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business. But, but we played it back then, and I was at my friend Leonard's house, and there were a few girls there, a few boys there, and we were spinning the bottle and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. Now, these were not the first drinks I ever took, but these were the ones where I really started to connect the dots that alcohol would do something for me that I could not do for myself. And so we spun the bottle. The bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair, if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona, and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get. So much for fair. I just couldn't accept the things I couldn't change on the Natch. You know, I just, I would beat my head against the wall till it was bleeding and couldn't figure out why you wouldn't move the wall. You know, I just didn't get, I just couldn't do that. And I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for in junior high. And I started to back away from my life. I got my feelings hurt by my friends and my non-friends, and boys my age were looking at me funny, and so were the girls. And I started to back away from my life and started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom, and bringing stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets, and just hanging out until after a while school just didn't do it for me anymore either. And that was my last bastion of refuge, really. It was a place where it just seemed to me it was so unsubjective. I mean, you know, math, you don't need to, you're not emotionally involved in math or English or any of that stuff. You either do the work and you get the grade or you don't. And none of that mattered anymore. And I'll tell you, by the time I was 12 years old, any sign of creativity or talent or anything good, all that was good, I began to trade away willingly for the effect that alcohol would produce for me. And I started to leave home, and I have always had a gypsy heart. I've always been on the run. And all it takes really for me is a long, slow train whistle and a Willie Nelson song, and I'm on the road again. You know, I just want to go. It just seemed like hope was just up the road, and I love that feeling. And I love that feeling today. It's just that I like going home, too, and I have a home to go to, which is a big, big plus. And I could be found on the on-ramps of the 10 freeway going east or the 101 freeway going north, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. And I love that feeling. Consequently, I started spending a little time in the Southern California hot spots like Riverside Juvenile Hall and Indio Jail and LA Central Juvenile Hall, and it would go like that. And they'd try to send me home to mom and home to dad, and we did that little circle dance for a little while. And when I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area where a couple of guys offered my friend and I money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And I started letting old men stick needles in my arms, and my life began to change dramatically from there. And it just seemed to me that there were more people out there doing what I knew to do than they were back home. And every time I went out on the road, the more those feelings of difference would increase in me, and the less I was able to relate to the people at home. And I certainly wasn't going to tell them where I'd been on my summer vacation, that's for sure. So I kept running. And by the time I was 15, the courts took over. I became a ward of the court, and they admitted me to a mental hospital for observation. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved on in. And they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child, alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration down my gut I've not had experience in a very, very long time. Back then, what I know I was now was restless, irritable, and discontent. And when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard it being described as like being a scream without a mouth. And I so felt like that. I so identified with that feeling. I just didn't know, and I didn't know how to talk about what was going on inside. And they were giving me daily nutritional supplements of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmine sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints. And that's what I looked like at 15 years old. Today I know that I know I'm an alcoholic. And the only reason I know that is that when all those years later, on September 25th, 1987, where I was finally washed up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous, finally sick and tired enough to pick up this kit of spiritual tools and use them, that it started to work. And that's how I know I'm an alcoholic. When I apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life and to my day, I incorporate them into my life, I get better. And that's how I know. But I had to be desperate enough, I guess, to pick them up and try. They just all seemed so simple. You know, it seemed like some thinly veiled Sunday school. I've seen all of those before. How could that possibly have an effect on me? But none of us knew that back then. And like I said, I ended up being in that hospital for about a year. I had to get busy. If you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And this was not a treatment center. There were not a lot of treatment centers out back then. It was a mental hospital. There were people in there with some real serious things like schizophrenia, manic depression, alcoholism, I'm sure, but they weren't diagnosing me as an alcoholic at the time. And if you don't want to go crazy, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was boys. I've already told you that. I loved all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy smoldering types. You know the kind. Some of you are sitting back there simmering right now. I can see it. I can see the smoke. You know, you just never really knew when they were going to blow. You know, I just loved those guys. And, you know, I just found them very exciting. Now, today I know that feeling is fear. So I stay away. But, like my first boyfriend, the trouble with guys like that is that they're always getting hauled off to YA. They blow eventually, and they get hauled off, because they're in the hospital hiding from a little sentence anyway. But like my first boyfriend, he blew, and he ended up being hauled away for throwing a chair through the window. And my next boyfriend, he blew, and he threw a nurse through the window. So that was progressive, too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life, you know, music playing in the background of all this drama. And just, you know, just, and back then we played those sentimental jailhouse songs, you know, like, oh, when will I see you again? And just, you know, oh. And I remember one afternoon sitting outside on a smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. You know, he's the one who threw the chair through the window, and I'm watching, and I just can't believe this whole tragedy going down. And I am just smoking my tragic cigarettes and channeling Greta Garbo, you know, and watching him being escorted off. And I just, inside the girls' unit, I can hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," and just walk away. God, it just hurt so good. You know what I mean? And it took me a long time to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. Because it's the way I see my life. You know, it's the perspective I take. And I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me, you know, and it's just, I was always about a half a bubble off what it was I thought I was looking at anyway. I mistook arrogance for confidence. I mistook sex for love. I mistook brute strength for strength of character. And I get it up in my life and it turns to dust because it's just not real. It's not it. And it took all these years coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that it's when I give them myself that gaping hole in my soul gets smaller. Never going to come from out there. But it took me a long time to learn, and I tried everything. And I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to Ward D, or the ward where they put all the patients they don't know what to do with. And I was there at the end of that year, and I met the love of my life there. And I was a vision for you. By that time, I was no longer bathing or getting dressed, because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting. And that was just a whole different way to change my reality. And I'd sit on the day room couch and smoke my cigarettes and hang. And after a few months of that, I met the love of my life. Like I said, he was there kicking heroin in 17 days like we do, and I went over the wall with him for the last time. And I was 16 years old. He was 22. I was coming off Thorazine. He introduced me to cocaine, and woohoo! I think it was just too much of a contrast for him, really. And you know, he couldn't handle it. I was a very sick kid, and so was he. And oddly enough, about 2 weeks later, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me, and it hurt my feelings to discover that he'd called her. And come get her. She's right here. And ending up in another rehab and sitting in front of a judge waiting for placement. It just went like that through my whole adolescence. And I ended up at the end of that at 17 years old in a girls' home in Pasadena. And I met my roommate, and we were on the same page, man. I come from the tail end of the 60s, and my higher power was peace and love and flowers and the Grateful Dead and all that I thought the 60s must have been, because I was 12 in 1969, so they were over by the time I got out in the world. But I loved what I thought they were. You know, people marched and they said no, and they stood up and they were active and they meant it, you know, and there was just a spirit that I was so in love with. And that combined with the television series Kung Fu. A lot of you guys might remember that series. David Carradine was a star of that show. He played a Shaolin priest, and that dude walked the Wild West in bare feet. You know, he was tough, and I loved him. I mean, he could change your life in three words. Pearls of wisdom just rolled off his tongue. You remember that? And he just, I mean, you know, this was full. You could, I just, you know, my fiance, he rented me the old series, and I want to still, you know, watch. But the best part about this guy was when they messed with him, he kicked their ass. You know, and it was just, it was my idea of strength and serenity. You know, nobody was going to mess with me anymore. And I swore I would never become the parent that I had had. And I already, though, I was living in the very things I resented and that I was afraid of. And we're talking to our friends, and our friends said, man, all those people, they moved to Oregon. You got to go up to Oregon where God might be. And so we went out the second story window, that girl's home, and down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And we went up there, and they let me come with them, and they rented a little house up there. And I wasn't doing what I'd been doing to make a living for a little while, because I was a terrible thief, and I certainly didn't want to go get locked up again. But you know, besides that, when they talk about hoeing in Springfield, Oregon, they meant with a garden tool. It was just a whole different way of thinking. They did it in their front yard. But two things happened that I could see only looking back. I certainly couldn't see it when it was happening. And one was, when I couldn't drink the way I needed to drink, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I had no sufficient substitute. I had nothing to replace that craving or the obsession with. I had no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding. And when I could drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17 years old. And my friends had asked me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot of places. And I ended up in a circuitous route back down to my father's house, down in Covina, staying with him against his better judgment. And every morning we'd get up at the same time, and he'd take off for work, and I'd take off for his liquor cabinet. And I'd sit in his den, and I'd drink until the end of the day, and he'd come home, and he'd see me sitting in the very spot where he'd left me that afternoon. And I'd look at him and his broken-hearted eyes, and I had nothing to say for myself, really. I didn't know what there was to say. I didn't know I was afraid. I didn't know how to tell him. I didn't know where the last few years of my life had gone, and I felt old. I was 17, and I felt old. And right before my 18th birthday, my father had to say some very hard words to me. He had asked me to leave, and I know that that was difficult for him. He said, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And on my way out the door, all I could think of was that the fact that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. And I was 18 years old, start my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. And there was not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And, one gray day after another. And to this day, I love it when I get to drive through Hollywood past that same bus stop on Sunset Boulevard near Poinsettia Avenue. Some of you might know it. And I see a whole new generation of the same girl sitting out there with very little hope about it getting any different. And I get to say a prayer of gratitude for me and a prayer of hope for her that maybe she'll get to find what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous, if alcoholism is her problem. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes. And I didn't realize it was Orange Sunshine, but we hit it off. And I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. But I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. I'd gone through his life like that proverbial tornado in 6 weeks, and it was clear. And I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking for that guy, and I couldn't find him. And my sponsor finally said, you're going to have to set that down now for a while. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. So in the meantime, there are some things you can do to change yourself, change your own behavior, like try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? And I did. And, actions, again, make room for the feelings and the thoughts and everything else. And all these years later, I have friends of both genders. I know how to be a friend, and I know how to have a friend. And right up there with that feeling of being useful is that feeling of self-respect. And I value that feeling very much, of being able to walk into any room with the lights completely on and look at anybody in the eye and to know that I'm clean, or if I've done someone wrong, I can change that. I can make amends for that. But I don't have to look down when I see you now, and I don't have to walk in the shadows, and I don't have to take second seat just because of the way that I feel about myself. And right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I did not feel like going. Thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. And I went out and I gave the talk, and I love that you guys taught me how to show up. I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know, it just seemed like I just want to be invited. Don't really want to go. And I went and I gave the talk, and of course I felt better. It was over, and the thank you line came through, and this man stopped, and he said, "Where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. Now, only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I and all my efforts to get that done couldn't make it happen. And so it reminds me, I still love to tell that story all these years later, because it reminds me that God's timing is always perfect, even when I don't think it's happening fast enough or just right. Or I think, man, I got it now, you know, and start on that self-propulsion, and I just wait one more time. And I got to make direct amends to that guy, and he said, "Oh, God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." And he's right. You know, if we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones right here, right now. Somehow, some way, we managed to slip through that window of grace long enough to come in here and sit together and recharge and regroup and see what we can go back out there and pack into the stream of life. You know, we don't have to sit back anymore. And that was a long time to come, though. And I spent the rest of that year in Hollywood, and I took off, and I hooked up with another guy, of course, and we're both, again, flying on the coattails of the 60s, loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And so we, you know, we're sleeping on the side of the road. I've got the soundtrack, Jackson Brown and Bob Dylan, and the self-pity parade, you know, going through my head. And we pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass and threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight until the baby came. And we had this little girl, and I thought having this little girl was going to change the way that I drank and the way that I lived. It's got to be little girl and everything else, right? But alcoholism doesn't care who you love. And so very shortly after that, it became booze and kid and everything else. And we're drinking organic stuff, moonshine, homemade beer, homemade wine, you know, because it's better for you, right? And it doesn't matter. It's still booze and the kid and everything else. And she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road. Took her away from him and up into Idaho, where I've got 3 jobs, tending bar and cocktail waitressing. Never occurred to me not to drink on those jobs. Why else would you have those jobs? And had 3 great jobs, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we're living in the rent-by-the-week motels up there, and I'm dragging that kid around. And she's one of those kids by then that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And after a while, of course, Idaho's not working for us anymore either. I'm drinking straight scotch. I'm not mixing it with anything anymore because those mixers give you a hell of a hangover, really. And we're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina. I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar, and that's about 35-40 mile drive every day. And you know, so you get tired about halfway through. And I'd stop into this bar in Arcadia every day like clockwork. The bar was called the First Cabin. It's out there, some of you might know it. And stop in there every afternoon and have shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Max, and had them sat there for an hour or two, and got up off the bar stool, went out to Hollywood and poured drinks with everybody and drank till the wee hours of the morning, and started all over again every day like clockwork. My daughter was almost 4 years old by then, and one afternoon I kissed her goodbye like I did every day, and I went off to that bar in Hollywood, and I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia, had those same shots of Cuervo Gold and same Bud Max. And to this day, I can't see anything that was different on that day from the day before except 24 hours. Because I sat on that bar stool, and I had those same shots of gold, and I didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today, but I couldn't get off the bar stool. I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. So I sat on the bar stool, and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed, and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there. And I started the Drinkers Hall of Fame down the street, and I'd go down to Steer Burger and then up to Kelly's and back over to Tommy T's and back into the First Cabin. And I'd hit there about midnight, you know, when the booze is starting to wear down and the band is playing and the chatter in my head is going up. And I think about my daughter. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt you could walk her up to me and say, you know, you can have her back, Carla, if you just stop drinking. I knew that wasn't going to happen. And you know, the weird thing was, man, those were real drinkers in that bar. They were drinkers. They were drinkers and racetrack people, you know. And I just kept saying, man, you got to get me a job in one of those mutual booths, you know. You got to get me a job. And they'd say, man, Carla, when you can stop that tequila, we'll help. We'll stand behind you. We love you, but you got to stop drinking that tequila. And I thought, I would think, what the hell are they saying, you know? That's not very nice. You know, I see them drinking right up there with me, but I was the one. I thought maybe getting married might do it. I got another job in another dive bar finally, and I thought maybe getting married might do it. Maybe if I made my life look like yours was, and maybe that would do it. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved into that apartment, and we became an active household one more time. Bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the night stalker, and the only people we turned that gun on was each other. I just tried to get to it first, you know, and my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of our fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool. Now, there's a reason, right? I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs and nobody feeling sorry for me in that bar, just glad I was leaving. My husband picked me up and took me to the hospital, and I got fixed up, and he brought me home, and he had to leave for work that weekend. And before he did, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. And now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me really mean, you understand. And so I'm drinking this gin, and I've got this beer, and he's gone, and I'm dialing the phone. I don't know if we have any drunk dialers in the room, but I called a bunch of people. I don't know all of who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman's shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting, and I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And I found an AA meeting not very far from where I lived. It was there then. It's there now. It's a perfectly wonderful AA meeting, and I went in there with everything but readiness. I was feeling sorry for myself. I was spent. I was hungover. I was sick, and I still wasn't ready. And that's the one thing you can't give me. I can't give it to you. We have to take that walk on our own somehow, some way. That willingness has to come. And I went in there, and I heard the woman talk just like you're listening to now. I heard her say that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer, so I did. I thought AA says switch to beer, and I started drinking beer, and I stopped all the other stuff, and I'd come to and drink beer, and I'd drink beer all through the day until I passed out that night, and it gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. It allowed me to get a few more things done during the day before I got real, you know, useless, and it allowed me to go another couple years, and a whole lot more happened with us, and I got the kid back for better or worse a few years later, and my husband and the kid and I ended up across town in a little apartment in Pasadena, and I'm in a better position than I'd been in a very long time, and we're living indoors. I have a car. I have a little job. I'm answering phones for the city, and I'm hanging on to that job by a thread, but I've got it, and yet I'm dying of alcoholism more than ever. And that one final Saturday afternoon, our relationship ended when, like I told you, the cops were there, and they left eventually. They took the gun. The husband left for the last time, and it's me and the kid and the beer, and we're sitting there, and I can't stop drinking. I see my life falling down around me, and I still can't stop drinking. It's the thing that I'm using to figure out what's next. And my first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole fight go down. And a couple of days later, she came to my apartment, and she knocked on my door, and she sat on my couch. She brought me a big book and a 12 and 12, and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what got my attention and impressed me more about that was that it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that really got my attention, because I don't understand how you do that. You know, I know that when I've got nothing to replace that booze, man. I feel oversensitive and underloved. I feel like you stripped the coating off my wires. You know, I feel just too close to the edge. And sooner or later, I gotta go back to that first drink. Even though that window of relief gets smaller and smaller and smaller, I got nothing else. I got nothing to put between me and that. And so I don't know if her little 12 steps, her little 12 sentences, her little 12 thinly veiled Sunday school sayings are going to have any effect on me. And I didn't stop drinking that day. She left, and on her way out the door, she turned to me and she asked me if I had trouble accepting life on life's terms. And I said, absolutely not. Life sucks, and I fully understand that. And a little attitude problem. It was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more booze. And the DTs started to set in, and I started to shake, and I shook it out that weekend, and I saw and heard things that weren't there, and I just hung on, and I shook it out till Tuesday afternoon, and I went back to my neighbor instead of the store, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, and that became my first home group. I walked up there and heard a lot of hope in that room, and the hope that I heard, for whatever reason, came in the form of small talk. I watched all of you guys seeming to care about each other, and I sat way in the back by the exit sign, and just in case. And I watched and I listened, and At the end of that meeting, the secretary did something very nice for me. She brought me that portion of Chapter 11, A Vision for You, that we read at the end of a lot of meetings in Southern California, and I took it from her. I said yes, and I started to read. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit more. And every time I say yes to you and I do what you ask me to do, I come into the room just a little bit more. Stacking chairs and pouring coffee and washing cups and finding somebody who looks more uncomfortable than I feel, I come into the room just a little bit more. All these years later, yes is still the best answer in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And I thank you for that. I thank you for these little jobs that you gave me so I could have a place to put my feet and my body until my head and my spirit could catch up. I got my first sponsor, and the only requirement I had for that sponsor was the fact that that woman had not had a drink in 12 years, and I had no idea how to do that. I had no idea. I didn't know if I was going to make it another day, but I know that this woman hadn't had a drink, and I started to do what she asked me to do. And I hated her God. I hated her God, and I hated a lot of the things that she embraced. But she didn't teach me so much about her God, except that she loved her God and that she believed in it. But she taught me that I could have my own concept of God, and thank God that I did. But she left Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about 2.5 years sober, a little over 2 years sober. And had I had her God, had I followed exactly the things that she did, maybe I would have had to follow her right out. But she didn't. She taught me Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had it in me. And I invite you, if you're new, to come in here and have your own experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't let someone else have it for you. Do what they do and have your own. The funny thing is that woman was a year younger than I am now, and I thought, what the hell else has she got to do? Her life is over. anyway, my life is busier than it's ever been. And I started to take the steps with her, and I started to make those amends. And right about 9 months sober, that obsession to drinks finally left. And I was one of those people who would every single day, I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, and I probably needed every single meeting I went to for the first couple of years of my sobriety. I just needed to be immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed to learn the tools, and I started to hear the traditions, and I wasn't sure where they all applied, but I would listen, and I got busy. And I think one of my favorite commitments was that coffee commitment. You know, when I was 89 days sober, I had to drink one more time, and I went out for about 24 hours. I had to finish the drunk, and then I came back up, and I wasn't even sober. I was at our Friday night book study, and you guys didn't even wait till I got sober. Someone came up and said, hey, do you want to come up here on Tuesday and make coffee with me? And I thought, damn, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. You know, and I came up on Tuesday, and that guy never showed up much after that, but I got the coffee commitment. And man, I was in that meeting at 5:05. I'd get out of work at 5 o'clock. At 5:05, I'd be in that meeting, even though that meeting didn't start till 8 o'clock, because I'd be in the store buying coffee and stir sticks and cake and trying to figure out whose birthday it was. And I was thinking about somebody other than me. You know, you told me I needed to do that to get me off my mind. And the only way that I knew that I learned about self-centeredness was by experiencing finally the lack of it. And the way that I experienced the lack of self-centeredness was to be thinking about you. And that's how I learned. And the group was my higher power in the beginning. And I got very busy until these steps could take and I could have that internal conversion. And I did. And the awakening continues. And it has to. I have to enlarge my spiritual life. I have to. For that, I need God's help. And I made those amends to my family. That first round of amends, my amends to my family required a lot of follow-up, a lot. I mean, I had broken their hearts consistently over time. So if your family doesn't trust you in your first year, your first 2 years, even 5 years, man, you know, I know that mine, none of us knew if this thing was going to work. You know, none of us. And to this day, 23 years later, there's not one member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, no, don't go to the meeting. No, they all none of them do that. And we'll see you when you get back. Christmas in July, sure. We'll change everything. We don't care. Go to the meeting. But and my daughter, you know, the other women started asking me to sponsor them. And I found out in that the only fifth step that I like better than mine is yours. And I'll tell you why. Because in your fifth step, I see redemption and I see forgiveness and I see lovability and I see me and you. And there is nothing like what goes on between two alcoholics sharing at that level. Nothing. You know, I see that it's possible for me to change. I see it's possible for me to grow when I see that. And I learned a lot in my fifth step with my sponsor. But man, I see so much more when I see the light go on and when we get to share. And you reflect back to me. Like I said, after a couple of years, I had you guys. My daughter didn't have anybody, and she was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. And I was getting scared. She was 12 years old, and there were 18-year-old men coming in and out of our windows. And I was sleeping with my purse with my crackhead boyfriend in the other room and my daughter. And, you know, there was a lot of hell breaking loose. Still, you know, chips falling. I got sober and said, let the chips fall where they may. And they were. And I had to get some big help for her. And I had to put her in a treatment center for a while. And I had to stop going to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I had to, our book says on page 19, right up front in the book, it doesn't wait till the very end to say that a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. I had to learn it here first, and then I had to start to take it home. And this was the time. It was the cue. You know, your daughter needs you. I had to put her in a treatment center for a while. I had to go to one meeting a day, go to work, and then go, if they asked me, out to that center and do the work with her. And you guys taught me that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, and that's how they're done, a little bit at a time, and give it my best spoonful every day. And after 6 months, she got out of there. She wanted to go. She stayed with me for a few months, and she wanted to go live with her dad. And I had to back up and let her go do that and accept things. And I kept going to work. And you guys taught me how to be consistent. And I'd never been consistent like that before. Never, ever. Any life that I have today, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to show up when I didn't feel like it and when I didn't think it was right and when I wasn't getting mine and when I saw no vision of how this is all going to end up, and to trust one day at a time that things are going to be the way they're supposed to be. And so she was living with her dad, and I'd pick her up on my weekends. And something about the divine map, the master plan, I don't know, but I turned 5 years sober, and I came home from the gym one night, and I went to bed, and I woke up, and there was a man standing over me. He had a knife, and he put it to my neck, and he tied me up, and he ended up raping and robbing me there in my bed that night, in my bed. And I'll tell you, you know, stuff like that used to happen to me when I was out on the street. And not that I was asking for it, but it was a lot more likely to happen in the positions I was putting myself way back then. But this time, all I had done was go home and go to bed. And this guy had come through the window. And now he's on my back, and I'm tied up. And more than ever, at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with, you know. And I told you, I had a whole, I've always been a seeker. I've always believed that there was some power greater than me. I've always believed in a God. I felt the presence of God long before I ever took a drink. When I was a little child, I felt the presence of God. I just didn't know how to access that consistently. I didn't know how to keep that. And a drink was always so much easier. You know, I could take a drink, and man, I felt better now. I didn't have to pray and wait and what's God's will and try to figure it out. Like life is one big trick question. You know, I just had to take a drink, and now that wasn't working anymore. I had to rely on God. I'm 5 years sober. There's a man on my back in the middle of my bed in the middle of the night, and now I trust. I trust that things are going to be the way they're supposed to be. That God either is or He isn't. You taught me in that second step. When I took that second step, I said I'm going to believe, and I got nothing to lose. I no longer had, at 5 years of sobriety, that immature God that exists when things go my way and doesn't exist when things don't go my way. I don't know what's supposed to happen. I just know that things are as they're supposed to be right in this moment. And right in this moment is always where I find my God. He ended up going out the same window he came in. It turned out that I had known him. I'd watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I choose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is where I've learned the terms and conditions of my disease. This is where I learn that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I learn that here, and then I go anywhere I want to in worship, anywhere I want to in practice, getting nearer my God. But I had to learn that. And my sponsor told me I was going to have to forgive this guy, and I know she's right. I know that we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments, And over the years, I thought I hadn't forgiven him, and I guess I was on my way to forgiving him, but there was some residual feelings left behind after this, and I was afraid I'd stand out on the sidewalk and someone would slam a car door, and I'd jump and I'd get pissed all over again. You know, I just couldn't stop being afraid and angry, and anger was my favorite way to react to my life still at 5 years of sobriety, you know. And I had to let it go, and that seven-step prayer became my mantra. And there was a court case that followed. That guy got caught a few weeks later, oddly enough. And as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I had known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be, including my ex-husband. And that's the mark I left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of the rapist than he was for me. And he's never been interested in any of my amends. So they got up and they talked all about me. And then by then, I needed to get a character witness for me. And by that time, I was working in a big financial institution, the Towers of High Finance in downtown Los Angeles. And the division head of the department where I worked at volunteered to come and testify on my behalf. And he came in there and they told him all about who I used to be. He sat in the witness stand and he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he had experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify, and I sat up in the witness stand, and I looked out, and I saw him sitting at the defense table. And it's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again. And it occurred to me that if I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And it occurred to me after that shortly that what we were two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And like it's laid out in the pages of the big book, that little recipe for forgiveness, you know, that I could see that he was a sick person like me. And just like a crack of light under the doorway, you know, I was able to start to let that go, to start to relinquish the fear that had me in such a grip, you know. And it took about a year and a half for all the nightmares and all the stuff attendant to something like that to go away, but it did. And he was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17, and he's not been able to stay out of prison. Now, I know that it's possible that they do. I know that I've been on a lot of many, many, many hospitals and institutions panels in the prisons and in the county jail, and I know it works. I've been to as fine a meeting on the inside of some of those places than I've ever been on the outside. And there's a place I go to in Central California, a men's colony, and some of those guys are never, ever getting out. And yet, through Alcoholics Anonymous, they found a way to be useful to themselves and to each other and to the people that they've harmed. And there's a guy in there who says, it's not about the address, it's about the attitude, you know, and some of them walk as spiritually free as you and I do. And but this guy, he hasn't. And the detective who worked that case came to me and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know. But whatever it is you're doing now, you keep doing it because it seems to be working. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And we moved on. You know, I had to learn a couple of lessons. And one of them was that just because I've stopped drinking doesn't mean the world has changed. And that God doesn't cause those things to happen to teach us a lesson. Sometimes I just get in the way of someone not looking to do God's will. And that we're all learning at different paces. You know, we're all learning at different times and places. And I just got in his way. And that's all it was. And I'll tell you, you know, during that time, there was a lady that we had been thrown together in Alcoholics. I'll talk about principles before personalities for just a minute. You know, when I was new, there was this lady, and we were always thrown together through Alcoholics Anonymous. We just couldn't stand each other. Really didn't like it. Kept trying to like each other. Couldn't stand it. We were just like this all the time. And we had we been drinking, we would have killed each other or one or the other a long time ago. But we kept getting thrown together, and through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing what we knew was right, whether we felt like it or not. For whatever reason, I was talking to her the day after this rape had occurred, and she said, oh my God, she said, I'm sending Kenny over right away. That was her husband. And I have to tell you that 5 years before that, there was nobody sending their husband over to come get me and not to stay with them at their house. You know, and so it just, you know, the transformation has occurred. If you're in this room, the transformation has already started, and it can continue if you stay in the room and stay sober. And allow this thing to take, start doing the things that we're doing here, and allow this thing to come in and experience it for yourself. I invite you to stay. And I'm so glad they didn't promise me it was going to be comfortable, because it hasn't been comfortable all the time, but it's certainly been worth it. 23 years sober, I stand before you, and I couldn't ever do anything 23 years in a row that was of any value on purpose before Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've had jobs. I've bankrupted myself physically, financially by the time I was 10. I want to tell you that my daughter came back to live with me, and I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson and my second grandson's. Now, God, they're 10 and 15 years old now. One plays JV football, you know, and they're going to be ushers at my wedding, and my daughter's going to be a bridesmaid. And about a year and a half ago, those boys sat with me while we watched their mother graduate from Cal Poly Pomona, and she wants to be a probation officer. And my father sat with me while I held my grandson and watched my daughter graduate from high school, you know. And I had become every bit the parent I swore I would never be. And then I got to grow out of that through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a whole lot of help from the fellowship. And I've had a few different home groups. I've had 6 different sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've needed everyone. Everyone has walked me to the very next. And my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well and he knows why. I've gotten to make amends to him. I owed him some money and I've tried twice to give him the checks for that and he won't cash them. And so I had to find another way, and I knew that for these amends, this was right. I get the dinners. I coordinate all the dinners and all of the family get-togethers. I'm the matriarch now, you know, and so I get them together and I get to cook for my father and for my grandkids. And I got to go with my dad while he picked out the suit to wear to my wedding so he can give his daughter away. I'm 53 years old and he finally gets to give his daughter away. My mom, she passed away about 2 years ago from end-stage liver disease. She never found our program, and but when she passed away, we were clean. We were good, you know. And she was one of the hardest ones I had to make amends to. About 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. And I blame my mother. I really, you know, we were all waiting. It took her all weekend to die. And while we were at the hospital, you know, with the family, be in the waiting room. And then I'd go out into the car, to the parking lot, and I'd drink from the booze I had in the van, and then I'd go back in the waiting room, and I'd just rake my mother across the coals, and I'd talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room, you know. And I don't know how you make amends for that, really, except that I started by calling her once a week and trying to find out how I might add to her life instead of take for a change. You know, and it required listening, which is what my mother just really needed from me, was to listen. And over time, we got very close, you know. Over time, we got so close that about 10 years ago, when my baby brother died of this disease, 30 years old, 6'10", 160 pounds, when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital, little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. He'd been in and out of prison, and he was, you know, he was 30 years old by then, and he finally passed away. And when he did, I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. So it wasn't for me to keep taking her inventory and to talk about what a crappy parent she was, because I had been every bit, and I could see me in her. And I knew that there, for the grace of God and a few steps in Alcoholics Anonymous and a whole lot of help, I'd be sitting in her very seat. And Howard P. always says, wherever you see God, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. And, you know, the awakening started when you walked into these rooms. And we took these steps, and the awakening continues. And then that 11th step, it there are so many different ways. I mean, people find it in different ways. Some find it reading. Some are actors. Some are musicians. Some people are artists. Some people, I turned into a dancer. I was 17 years sober and 47 years old, and I learned how to dance. And I didn't know I needed to learn how to dance. That's how I know my God exists, is he answers questions I don't ask out loud. You know, I don't even know those questions he's asking. But I ended up in an Arthur Murray dance studio learning how to do the rumba one day. And I didn't know I had become stiff. I didn't know how to wiggle anymore. I just like, you know, and taking me and everybody else way too seriously, you know. And my sponsees didn't want to call me. You know, they're like, no, you call her, I'll call her. I don't want to call her. It's just, I mean, you know, not that they didn't love me, but just... She's a little tight, you know. Maybe she'll get laid. I don't know. But so I'm in this Arthur Murray dance studio, and I don't know how tight I've gotten or how serious. It creeps up on you, you know, that perfectionism. If I can't be perfect, maybe somebody will. And anyway, so I'm in there, and my teacher is trying to get me through this class, and finally he slaps his forehead and he says, oh my God, Carla, don't try to dance like a good girl. I don't think they will believe you anyway. And yeah. So our book promises that in God's hands, our dark past becomes our greatest asset. And my past has been woven into a huge tapestry that's my life. It's there for those who need to see it to see it. And yet I walk a free woman in the real world, awake and alive and looking you in the eye. I've got a real life today, and I've got a real God. And I know that there's a God because he answers questions I don't ask out loud, and I never knew they needed asking. And so if you're new, I want to invite you to come in here and have an experience for yourself and follow those of us who have had one so that you can have one too. We're here to share it with you. Thank you.